Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Nathaniel Mulcahy, owner and founder of World Stove, a company that produces and distributes pyrolytic stoves all around the world. These stoves are tailored to fit the specific needs of each culture and community that uses them. And after they're done burning the fuel, they're left with biochar that they can use to replenish their soil. Brent Verrill, a listener to the show and a contributor to conversations on the Facebook page at facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, suggested Mr. Mulcahy and included a link to an article from the Huffington Post detailing the work of World Stove. After looking over that material, the World Stove website, and considering my recent experience at the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture workshop on charcoal and biochar, I wanted to interview Nathaniel. The elegance of his system and the ability to turn what would otherwise be waste products into fuel is an enticing prospect. During this interview, we discuss his background and how he came to create World Stove, which was an even more interesting journey than how many of us come to permaculture. He and I also talk about the World Stove mission to create local jobs, improve local economies, and ensure that waste biomass is used as fuel, all while reducing emissions, sequestering carbon, and building soil. If you enjoy this interview or any other episode of the show, please consider making a donation. You can do so by going to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Now then, on to the interview with Nathaniel Mulcahy. I'll join you again afterwards with more thoughts. Well then, Mr. Mulcahy, if you can give us a little bit of your background and how you came to the work that you're doing with World Stove.
I'd be happy to. Pleasure meeting you, Scott. Nathaniel is fine, actually. I've got a sort of circuitous route to my career, which is enjoyable, and I think it gives me a nice, rich background, which is a nice way of saying it took me a while to figure out where I was going. As a former school teacher, I eventually went back to school and got an engineering degree and then several other engineering degrees, and eventually ended up doing quite well with that. And at the point of industry, I had become the director of research and development for Emerson Appliances in Europe. It was great. And while I was working at Emerson Appliances, some dear friends of mine got married, and they did something really unusual for their wedding. They decided that they'd survey all their other friends who had recently been married and said, asked what the cost of their weddings had been. And they figured the cost was between $20,000 and $30,000 for a wedding, which, you know, 15 years ago, it's still a lot of money, but back then it was an even more amount of money. And they decided that instead of spending that much on a wedding, that they would use that money to help build a school in Haiti. So they took the same amount of money for the school, and then everybody else was required to bring a hot dish to the wedding. I think the total cost of their wedding was a few hundred dollars. And everybody else brought in food, and other people volunteered and brought music. And it was a beautiful, beautiful wedding. But what was more beautiful is that they chose to begin their life together by building something very positive. And I liked that idea. I liked that image a lot. A year later, I asked them how their school was going, and they told me that it had been closed. And it didn't make sense. I mean, I've been in the humanitarian field now for 12 years, but at the time, I didn't really understand the humanitarian world and the idea that you would build a school, fill it with computers, provide salaries for teachers, and it still wouldn't work, didn't click in my mind with anything that was possible. So I asked them, why on earth are the schools not being successful? And the answer was simple. It was in a very rural part of Haiti. The children who would normally be the students, because of the deforestation, we're spending between 8 and 10 hours a day gathering scraps of wood just for cooking, not for heating it or anything, just for the daily cooking. And if you're spending between 8 and 10 hours a day gathering wood, there isn't time to be a student. There isn't time to be a kid, let alone study. So as an engineer and directing large programs where we were being paid millions and millions of dollars to shave off small percentages to increase the efficiency of home appliances, the engineering mind kicked in, and I thought, wait a second, if Whirlpool and Miele and Maytag are pushing to improve efficiencies and change the class of their appliances. Maybe there's a way to improve the efficiencies of however they're using their wood. So in a little bit of research, it turned out this standard Haitian stove that uses wood, and the wood users in Haiti, by the way, are the very poorest of people in Haiti. The next level up on the energy ladder, I think that was Professor Smith's term, where he coined the term for Kirk Smith for determining socioeconomic status based on what energies you use. The next level up would be coal, charcoal, and then the next level up above that would be natural gas or propane. So the stick users or the twig users were clearly the poorest of the poor. And when I was in Haiti, I actually got that confirmed when people would drive by on a small mototaxi with large bundles of twigs, and my colleagues would look up to them and shake their heads and go, oh, poor people. So anyway, a bit of a rambly approach, but the result is the three-rock stove, which is surprisingly what almost half of the world's population cooks on today. And by three-rock stove, it really is just three rocks, and you stick some twigs underneath it and put a pot on top of it. Those figures are daunting, and the efficiency of a three-rock stove is about 12% in terms of combustion efficiency. So if I can work on making a dishwasher pump slightly more efficient, or the fan that cools the glass of your fancy oven so you can touch the glass while baking chocolate chip cookies more efficient or more quiet, certainly I could improve on 12%. 12% is a very, very low bar, and so to bump it up a notch shouldn't be, or at least I thought, shouldn't be too much trouble. The end result was the Lucia stove. And the Lucia stove came in with a combustion efficiency of about 93%. So it was a big improvement, big, big, big improvement. So with that, World Stove, in a roundabout way, was born. I did it on weekends 12 years ago. It was sort of a hobby business, and I wasn't very good at it. My first program in Haiti was an abysmal failure. We went in with our stoves. We didn't have a formal evaluation system in place. We didn't have follow-ups. We didn't have the obligation for local partners. And so 6 months later, when we went back to check up on the stoves, it took us about 2 weeks to find only one of the remaining stoves. And it had been painted bright blue and had soil in it and beautiful flowers growing out of it. Yeah, well, you have to start someplace, right? 12 years, however, provides you with a real learning curve. And in those 12 years, I was blessed with really the most fortunate thing that has ever happened to me in my life. I had a terrible accident. I shattered my neck, was paralyzed from mid-torso down, spent 18 months in a hospital, 12 surgeries, had to relearn how to walk. And 18 months in a hospital gives you an awful lot of time to think about what you want to do with your life. And when I got out, as sort of an act of thanks, I quit my job and decided to devote the rest of my life to doing humanitarian work and taking the high corporate approach that I had developed as a director for a large multinational to humanitarian work. And on a side note, I also tried taking every single dance class that I could find. I couldn't move my legs for a long time. It seemed like the right thing to do. I still can't dance worth beans, but the business is going well. And we are in contrast to a lot of humanitarian work, we are a social enterprise. So we are a for-profit company. The difference is, by being a social enterprise, we are a for-profit company, which, while we are allowed to make a profit, a significant, if not the majority of our profit, then gets reinvested into other humanitarian and environmental issues. So the in-pocket profits for the corporation are remarkably lean. But the good that we do is what we're seeing as our main payment. And so 12 years, no debt, doing well. I think it's going all right.
Well, I'm glad that you've had the successes that you have since those beginning days of failure, and also just the candor of sharing that failure with us. Often I know that it's easy to tell a story of the successes and not point to those moments that really are those moments that we learn from in order to advance. And to hear that gives a more human element to that. And I'm thankful for your recovery from your accident as well. Even if dance is not something you're good at least you went out and tried. We're able to turn that period into something productive. So 12 years later, you've developed your Lucia stove. And my understanding is that this is a pyrolytic stove, so it will produce biochar in the process?
Everything we do, our whole business model, is based on the fact that our stoves are pyrolytic. Again, to be completely candid, we had not intended to make a biochar-producing stove 12 years ago. The objective was to create a stove which had the lowest possible emissions and the highest possible combustion efficiency. So if you strike a wooden match, I don't know if in the studio you happen to have a packet of matches, but it might be worth taking one out and taking a look at it as it burns. But you'll notice that there'll be a little white tip to the flame, and then a orange tip, and then a bluish ball of flame all before the wood. And then the wood itself will be black, while other parts of it will be glowing red. And then the end parts where the black had started already will also start to develop some white on it. What all that means is you have multiple fuels, both solid and gaseous, burning at the same time. And to control multiple different combustion issues at the same time is, I believe, an unnecessary engineering challenge. If you have a methane stove and you're going to convert it to propane, you'll have to change the nozzles on it. The reason you change the nozzles on it is the nozzles are optimized for the best mixing of gas and oxygen so that you have the best combustion efficiency for that specific fuel. So when we started to develop the Lucia stove and keep the emissions down and make the fuel efficiency go up, we decided to take all those little combustion fuels that you're seeing in the match as it's burning and select one and tune just for that. So in the end, really what we did was sort of a lazy approach. Instead of trying to fix all the different combustion issues, we just chose to narrow it down to one and clean that combustion. By going with pyrolysis and not burning the solids, we only had to deal with the gas. So dealing with just the gas means a lot less work, and you can tune to that. As an added bonus, by rerouting the air flows within the stove, so that, unlike a T-LUD, we would then have the air pass through the fuel downward and then up through the sides, we could use the pyrolyzed biomass and the non-pyrolyzed biomass as a pre-scrubber for the gases that were being developed. So we were filtering our own gases and producing the gases. And then at the very end, all that was left was the pyrolyzed material. And the stoves were designed specifically to not be able to burn those. Again, going back to mistakes that you couldn't predict, while our first stoves got turned into flower pots, a lot of other stoves, when they'd finished using the fuel that was designed for them, we found that people would start putting charcoal or big branches of wood in it, and so that would defeat the purpose of the design. So we had to specifically design the stove so that it wouldn't function with other fuels.
Now, when you say that the stove won't function with other fuels, do you mean that in the sense that each stove will only burn a particular type of biomass, or that it only generates a certain fuel to burn in the process?
A great question. So in most of our locations, we tune to a specific type or series of biomasses that are available as a waste product in that region. We pelletize it, which helps create local jobs, but also provides uniform density, surface roughness, and moisture content, which makes a nice marketable item. Again, providing local jobs and revenue. we found that in a lot of regions, people would then, when they ran out of their pellets, rather than go to the hub and pick up another batch, they'd chop down a tree and stick large branches in it. The early models would allow those to still work in some degree, but then we found that it was defeating our objective of only using waste biomass if people would then, as soon as they didn't have that handy, would run out and chop down non-waste biomass. So we redesigned the stove so that it would be incapable of using the non-waste biomass. If somebody were to take a tree and chop it up now and stick it into a Lucia stove, it would make an enormous amount of smoke and not a whole lot of heat. So that helps people avoid the temptation of using biomass, which trees, frankly, are really good at sequestering CO2, so might as well leave them in place and let them preserve the biodiversity and let them preserve the CO2 they've already sequestered.
So in that process, what kinds of biomass are you able to tune the stove to? What kind of waste products are you using in different areas?
I'm glad you specified in different areas because it varies from country to country. So in northern Burkina Faso, we tuned the stoves to run on karité shells. The industry up there, there's the shea butter for cosmetics, and the plant is called karité. Have you ever seen a horse chestnut?
Yes, I'm familiar with that.
So sort of black orb, slightly smaller than a golf ball. The karité seeds look about the same. And they smash them and boil them to get the shea butter, but then they're left with mountains and mountains of these shells, which have a slight oil content remaining in them. And these are literally just burned multiple times a year to get rid of them, because it's a nuisance to have these giant piles of nuts lying around. It also attracted a lot of vermin. So that being something that they burned to dispose of to avoid any health issues clearly was a waste product, so we tuned to that material. And a stove that runs on karité, because it has a slightly higher oil content, won't work well with another biomass. A stove, for example, in Uganda, we have, not Uganda, Rwanda, we have stoves that'll run on eucalyptus. Eucalyptus trees shed an enormous amount of bark and leaves each year, and so without cutting the tree, without harming the tree, we can harvest sufficient biomass to provide villages with all their fuel needs. Egypt was a nice option. Egypt burns 20 million tons of rice husks a year, so we had to tune to rice husks for Egypt. And in Haiti, during the emergency response, we even tuned the stoves to run on the waste packaging from the other humanitarian organizations that were in Haiti at the time.
That's incredible. And the very technical side of myself wants to start asking questions about how you tune the stoves to do that and what the research and experiments are, but that may be a little too much for this interview.
Happy to answer them on a future conversation if you'd like.
I would like that. I know many people who are makers and interested in sustainable projects and localizing a lot of the technology that they find out there. I was just at a biochar workshop for doing renewable energy on a farm, and there was a charcoal gasifier used as a demonstration running into a gasoline engine that was actually producing electricity while we were standing there off of charcoal gas. And then a friend of mine and I are going to a micro hydro event, and it happens my friend who's going with me actually designs turbines for a living. And he's interested in going to see this because he's thinking about, well, how can I take their turbine designs and make them more efficient? There's a lot there that I would love to pick your brain about for some of those folks, but we can do that another time. From there, you have these stoves in nations all over the world, and you're creating jobs out of this with the stoves, because my understanding is that the stoves themselves, once you tune them and come up with a design, you're able to get the pieces of the stoves to the local community where they can be built then on site. Is that correct?
That is correct. So, I mean, one of the ways we can get the higher efficiencies and the very, very low emissions is because of the precise manufacturing. We have two different approaches to most of our stoves. One is through a series of turret presses we have, and the other one is through a foundry. Different models. The Lucia Origami is done in small batches with a CNC laser system, whereas the large batches, to keep the cost down, we go to a turret press where we have custom-made tooling for each specific tuning. The highest volume ones, however, we can keep the costs even lower because we then go to injection molding where we have the most complex version of the Lucia stove, which are injection molded aluminum top and bottom plates and then simply rolled metal for the insides. The capital investment for any of these three approaches would be well beyond the means of most of the villages that we work in, and in some cases, most of the regions that we work in. By having two centralized manufacturing locations in northern Italy and now slowly shifting the majority of that to the United States, we absorb the initial capital investment. During the pilot programs, we tune the stoves to local cooking traditions and biomasses, and then we produce in series the components that are needed for those locally specific stoves. So a Lucia stove, for example, for Ethiopia will burn at a very high temperature for about 40 minutes. And that's because the main cuisine there uses a mitad, which is like a large clay griddle. And their cooking is very high temperature and more like frying and takes place in about 40 minutes. Whereas a Lucia stove using the same basic four components for Zambia, rather than cooking at a high temperature for 40 minutes, is tuned to cook at a medium to low temperature for about 6.5 hours. Clearly, a Zambian stove would be lousy at cooking Ethiopian food and vice versa, but the significance is by respecting local cooking traditions, we also increase acceptance rates of the stoves. In both cases, we tune for the stoves to be used as a single batch run. That keeps the cost down, and it also increases what was one of the happy unexpected things that came back from our evaluation surveys, that the main reason people were accepting the stoves is it meant they didn't have to refuel the stoves. There was only one country where that was a problem, and we had to change the stove for that. But in most cases, people liked the fact that they could put the stove, load it up with fuel, put a pot on it, walk away, and when they came back, the meal would be ready.
And that's one load of fuel, whether they're cooking at a high temperature for 40 minutes or 6.5 hours at a low to medium, just one load of fuel because it's been tuned.
That's correct, because we tune it to the specific cooking traditions. To finish answering your question from before, though, by having the central manufacturing, we can keep the cost down, but keep the quality and the precision up. And then the four main components then are shipped unassembled, which saves on import taxes, to the local hubs. And then they assemble them to local specifications and, in many cases, add on added components, which are either cultural requirements, aesthetic requirements, or culinary requirements to be able to adapt to different types of cuisine. So that way, instead of our manufacturing facility having to produce 16 different models of Lucia stove, we still produce the one basic model with tuning for 16 versions, and then those are assembled by the different areas that have the 16 different styles. That means local manufacturing gets the high quality production and lower cost of mass production advantages, but still gets the local manufacturing jobs that are not possible without large capital investment.
And you just touched on what my next comment was going to be, is blending the high-tech precision business models from the West to produce, or if you will, the global North, a lot of the things that we've been investing in those societies to produce materials that are very useful and affordable and of value to the global South. It's incredible.
Thank you.
Yes, I'm very much impressed by it, because when you were talking about manufacturing but sending in unassembled, well, then to overcome the import tax, that lowers the cost then to the individuals who actually need this product. When you think about, what is it, the 2 billion people who live on $2 or less a day?
Right.
And how that makes that affordable.
The affordability is an important component. I think what is even more important, though, is the fact that they are creating local jobs. Rather than going in with stoves and having them resell it, as a reseller, you would create a few local positions. But as a company which creates locally produced pellets, locally produced stoves, you then have maintenance people, pellet producers, biomass sorters, marketers, biochar collectors. There is an entire chain of employment that gets created. That's the part that I'm really pleased with. It's the low cost is nice, but if you have a low cost product, but you have no way to earn income, what's the point? I mean, that means every product is still too expensive. The real way to lower cost is by increasing local economies.
You wind up creating an industry then that benefits many people. It's that hand up then that comes from that. Rather than going in and handing out stoves to people who need them just as a handout, you actually produce something that's self-sustaining within that community.
Exactly.
That's beautiful. One thing about the technologies, because we've mentioned the pellets on at several points, do you also then produce pelletizers that are useful for each of the biomasses that you've selected for an area, and then you create a pelletizer for that community as part of the industry?
We do. In most cases, we take standard hammer mills and pellet mills and modify the dies and rollers for the specific biomasses and cooking traditions. So that too is part of our tuning parameter. In one very elaborate variation to that, though, in Afghanistan, the ability to create employment for women is hampered by the fact that in many of the regions, women are not permitted to leave the house. So at the request of the World Food Program a few years ago, we started a new product, which we're now continuing with two other organizations. And it is a completely world stove produced pellet mill, but it is single person sized and about the size of a sewing machine. So in the end cost for the pellets and obviously the machinery is going to be much higher, because you are going to have, instead of one large central unit where people come to work, you have many, many, many small units, and the tools and the dies of the mills themselves are the most expensive component there. So you're increasing the initial cost manyfold. The advantage, however, is it means that each individual household can have a small unit, which is about the size of a sewing machine. The local organizations can then gather the biomass and drop them off at the houses once a week and retrieve the pellets they produce from the biomass that was produced, dropped off the week before. So this way, individual households, the women who are not permitted to leave their households, have still an option for generating revenue and income for themselves. So this is economic empowerment at the very basic level. The people who most needed the jobs weren't allowed to leave the house, so we reinvented the pellet mills and our business model so that the jobs could come to them.
And that makes me think, I was at a lecture with Susan Godwin, who was an Oxfam female food hero from, I believe it was Nigeria, if I'm remembering correctly. And she was talking about how having industry for women changes the power structure and also increases the amount of equality within those communities by women being able to raise funds directly and aren't necessarily as directly dependent on their husbands, and how that in many ways creates more peace among the community. And that's always of interest to me as well.
I'm in full agreement, as long as the earning potential isn't reduced from the men. I think as long as you are creating new opportunities for both genders, then peace is preserved and certainly prosperity grows. If, however, you are going to remove employment from one group, one gender or the other, to provide employment for one, it doesn't solve a problem by creating a new one. I think she's correct, with the caveat that you take a global approach and say, not how do we help one specific group, but how do we help an entire community?
Thank you for your observation on that. Oftentimes, one culture, one location is where the focus can wind up being, but having that global approach and thinking about how we all benefit is a useful one to be reminded of as we do this work.
Scott, I mean, by you mentioning the global approach, that's really one of the things that's nice about this program. I mean, so yes, we do create a local job, and we do create local stoves, and people can cook. And the individual household who doesn't have to spend every 4 minutes putting another twig underneath the three rocks, that person is happy. But if at the same time you're reducing CO2 levels, the benefit is global. I mean, we hit 400 parts per million the other week. That's not a local problem. That's a global problem. So the benefits globally are not just community-wise. We really have to focus on how everybody can help make the world a cleaner place.
With that thought in mind, how do you see your work and the work of WorldSove helping the world?
Well, because we became a company that focused on pyrolytic systems, if you take the biochar that's produced in an average day in an average household, you're looking at about 500 grams of biochar. If you take that 500 grams or half a kilo and multiply it by 0.8, you get a very good approximation of the amount of carbon that's present in that biochar. If you multiply that 0.8 by 3.67, you get a very accurate understanding of how much CO2 is then captured in that small amount, that handful of char. If you start adding those up and you do not allow that char to get turned into charcoal briquettes, and you make sure it is sequestered or used for soil restoration, that CO2 that is sequestered, take then desert areas or areas where soil degradation has been so extensive that no food crops can be grown. If all of a sudden you're able to once again grow trees in a region because you've restored the soil thanks to this stuff, then those trees are sequestering more CO2, and you have a ripple effect of how these different benefits start to benefit each other and grow even more benefits. And communities no longer have to import food, but have export food. Trees are coming back, which preserves the soil biodiversity and the animal biodiversity. Flora and fauna biodiversity allows for healthier ecosystems, which benefits globally everywhere. If you look at climate change, if you look at peak oil as being an issue, we also have peak wood, considering that 3 billion people use wood to cook, as an issue. We also have peak water, which is coming because of climate change, where there are regions who have little or no water and are predicted to have even less, meaning massive migrations of people, which will eventually lead to wars. If, however, you have an ability to, through your own local approach, your locavore approach to economies, restore local ecosystems, that those ecosystems can then start growing food again. And the reason they can do that is not only because you restored the soil, but the biochar allows the plants to be drought tolerant. It means you need less water to grow more food, and the economies can remain local rather than having to have people migrate. So ecologically, economically, in terms of migrating populations, which would lead to war, all of those things. I mean, it sounds crazy to talk about such huge benefits from teeny tiny cook stoves, but I really believe that that's possible.
I'm running all those numbers through my head, thinking about if you have a million stoves in place that are being used for three meals a day, and you're producing that certain amount of biochar at each point, and how much CO2 that's sequestering and restoring the soil and your plant. It's the little changes and the huge possibilities.
Exactly. If you think about it, a single cook stove used only for cooking will produce enough biochar to allow you to plant over 6,000 new trees a year. If there are 3 billion people doing that, what is the global impact? What if instead of those 6,000 trees, you plant 6,000 tomato plants and therefore have an economy that can be run selling vegetables as an export? What are the benefits then? I mean, these are nice big numbers, and completely doable. On the flip side, it seems like this is a confession hotline, because I keep coming up with mistakes that I've made in the past. But one of the problems we had, Scott, when we were doing these things, is we thought, great, people are going to make more food and it's going to be fantastic. And because they don't have to spend money on buying charcoal, they can, or compressed gas, or even wood, they can have more money to buy food and nutrition's going to be better. And we were feeling great about ourselves until we realized that if people are eating a lot more, they're going to be uneating a lot more as well. And in the regions where we were having success, we were also creating a sanitation problem because people were eating many more times a day, but had no improved sanitation systems to deal with. So all of a sudden, we had inadvertently caused sanitation crises in different regions. I mean, the most dramatic example of that was in Haiti during the emergency recovery period. People would eat the rice and beans we were providing, but then they'd hike up to the top of the hill in the IDP camps to relieve themselves, which that way the smells wouldn't be in the camp. But on the rainy season, all of that washed down into where we were sleeping, which made it clear that a solution was necessary. So again, thanks to biochar, we were able to take the biochar that came from the stoves, use that to then create a sustainable sanitation system. And from the very rudimentary versions that we made during the earthquake, we've now evolved biochar-based toilets, which are providing communities not only with clean sanitation option to deal with the fact that they need more options after they're eating more, but because as a byproduct there's extra heat, we also in one case even provided a community with their first hot shower ever.
So often, for all of my reading and all of my understanding and knowledge, hearing these stories on the ground still blow me away. To know about the change that's happening in the world and how this can be integrated into systems, large and small, wherever someone needs them. And I think about that biochar-based toilet and how you can use biochar in composting toilets, especially when you're doing urine separation, to help charge the biochar before it goes in. And about work at places like the Rodale Institute when they're looking at all these different ways to compost, and if we could use biochar in a composting toilet that's taking all human waste and then being able to turn that back onto a field, because then we're keeping fertility in the space where it's needed and it's not being exported.
Exactly. And the local approach, Scott, I mean, you really should come on one of our trips. We're always looking for people who have a willingness to work on the ground, and I think hands-on experience would give you some real insight into what we do. But I know we're running out of time. I wanted to touch on one last thing, which is sort of the exciting fact that we're local. In the humanitarian world, oftentimes you see the refuse of the first world nations being sent as a quote-unquote charitable gift to developing nations. And most of the times, that's not always a useful thing. What I'm really, really proud of is the fact that we've actually reversed that flow with our little company. Normally, so for example, a high-end computer now, in 5 years, will be considered a low-end obsolete computer. And at that point, it'll get shipped off to some developing nation. And we'll say, oh, don't we feel good? We've taken a computer and given it to a community that didn't have one. But then that community is learning on already obsolete technology. So while it is a nice thing to be doing, it is secondhand going in the direction of the developing nations. The Lucia stove was developed specifically for developing nations. And over the past 12 years, the number of people who have said, you know, that is really fantastic. We really like what you're doing for developing nations. But there are people who are hungry here. There are people who need help here, too. Couldn't you help us? And as of last year, we've succeeded in doing just that. The Lucia stove is now being beta tested in several houses in Massachusetts, not as a cook stove, but as a home heating unit. We took the main four components of Lucia stove, increased their power output, and built it around small furnaces and heating units so that now a technology that was third world is now a first world technology. And it's the third world which has been helping out the first world for a change. And I'm really, really proud of that. In Massachusetts, the battles that we saw in Haiti and Burkina Faso are present every day, although very, very invisible to the news media. If you think in Burkina Faso, people will spend between $2 and $3 a day for wood, just for cooking, and $0.05 a day for the food for a household. So you're looking at between 40 and 50 times more than the cost of food is the cost of the fuel to cook the food. In Massachusetts last year, the 2011 numbers at least, the 2012 numbers are not yet published, but the 2011, there were 211,000 households, so multiply by 5 for the number of people, who had to reduce the number of meals they ate per day because they could not afford to heat their homes. So once again, it's the food versus fuel economic dilemma. But it's here in the United States just as much as it is in Burkina Faso and Haiti.
And as you say, food and fuel and those decisions, I think about how then, as we have these other systems, how permaculture with that idea of providing food and fuel on site helps to further localize for a family or a community.
Absolutely. I couldn't have said it better. I mean, the locavore approach to economies and eating and everything, I think, is really what's going to drive the world's prosperity and not this globalization. It is returning to what we once did and what communities were able to do and survive for hundreds of years.
As we're running out of time, is there anything else that you'd like to share?
Sure. Two little things. One, the work we've done in Mauritania and Senegal in developing ways for plants to restore or reverse desertification, we've now succeeded in doing for coastal restoration in the United States. I mean, Sandy certainly brought coastal issues to the mind of many people in the world, but it is biochar is opening new and exciting frontiers, even in terms of coastal ecology. And our research teams have now been showing that with biochar, we are able to help restore, strengthen, and grow seaward shorelines that have been eroded by climate change and sea level rise.
Now I'm going to have to do some more reading and look into that research, because that also is pretty incredible. So many wonderful things that you've shared with us today. And I'm very, very thankful that you took the time to join us, I was going to call you Mr. Mulcahy. Thank you, Nathaniel, for joining me for the conversation.
Scott, a real pleasure. And Scott, thank you for your work. You've allowed the permaculture movement to take on a serious note, in a note that allows the higher powers of politics to understand the real importance of permaculture. And it's with that and with voices like yours that policy change can happen. So thank you very much for what you're doing.
Thank you. And I look forward to speaking with you again sometime.
Thank you, Scott. Talk to you soon.
And that was Nathaniel Mulcahy. As you heard throughout the interview, there were moments when I was a little awestruck by the work of his company and the possibilities ahead stemming from this idea. Living in a cool temperate climate at the bottom of a valley, I think about how one of these, particularly the scaled-up versions he mentioned, could radically change my home heating arrangement. Right now, my family and I use a mixture of oil and electricity for heat throughout the cold winter months. And even though our oil furnace is, according to the maintenance technician, extremely efficient, we still burn a little under the average for this region of 700 gallons a year. That creates a dependence on fossil fuels, whether we use the oil furnace or electric heat, and release over 7 tons of carbon dioxide a year just from the oil consumption. And I think about how this kind of a system, both for cooking and for heating, could be combined with on-site fuel production and become part of an overall design to make a location more local and more self-sufficient. Coppicing material in the land I live on, or using fallen woody material or other biomass that could be processed on site into the pellets that are needed for fuel. And that though there may be an upfront cost to install and use these items, can I really consider it an expense? Wouldn't it be more of an investment in freedom for my family and I? And the way then that I could turn that around and be more in tune to the ethics and principles of permaculture? Or imagine using Mr. Mulcahy's model of centralized production and local economy to install these stoves and heating systems in homes nearby, and then work with my neighbors to become producers of fuel. I could see this turning into jobs for members of the community to collect and deliver materials over a short distance to the production site, produce the pellets, and then return it to those who could use it, and also to generate a profit in a way that that money can be locally reinvested. But then, after that fuel is used, collect the unburnt carbon, use it in composting toilets or urine buckets, or in the litter for animal pens, and then later return it once it's charged with some nutrients to grow the next round of crops and biomass to be used as fuel. And then I imagine taking that model to an inner city and creating a company that partners with a local municipality to produce pellets from the common types of refuse from the public works. Or if you're near a sawmill, to take their scrap and all these other options that are available as we begin thinking of the different biomass that could be processed. And I won't say that you could produce all the fuel needed within the confines of, say, a major metropolitan area like London or New York or elsewhere, especially with how little green space exists in some of these places. But what would the impact be? But what would the impact be in the relocalization of economic opportunity this way? How would that build the connections within a community and reinforce the invisible structures that allow all of us to thrive and lift one another up? There are so many opportunities, and this is just the beginning. How could you use your knowledge of the work of World Stove to build a better community? I'd love to hear your thoughts. If after listening to this episode you have any comments or questions, please let me know. You can leave a message in the show notes for this episode, send me a tweet where I am at permaculturecst, or through the Facebook page, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast. Or of course, there's always email, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or by phone, 717-827-6266. Next week, Dr. Wayne Dorbent returns to discuss ecolonomics and creating the next generation of ecopreneurs. After that, on June 25th, is Bob Tice, an architect and natural builder. We discuss his work, what it was like to study with Christopher Alexander, and how to make natural buildings more appealing. On July 2nd, Eric Olson of Permaculture Artisans joins me to talk about professional permaculture, his work developing a permaculture skills center. We also delve into our viewpoints on models for advancing permaculture in society. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other. And here's the legal. The Permaculture Podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works license. Feel free to share it with whoever you like, but make sure you tell them where you got it, and don't sell it or change it.